Hey there. The name of this podcast is Art is Change, and this episode's question is, who says? From the Center for the Study of Art and Community, this is Art is Change, a chronicle of art and social change where activist artists and cultural organizers share the strategies and skills they need to thrive as creative community leaders. I'm Bill Cleveland. Here's something to ponder. Every time political pressure rises, every time governments tighten control, every time public speech starts to narrow and people begin to wonder what can still be said out loud, artists show up. Not because artists are especially noble, not because artists are fearless, but because our cultural and moral imagination is where what is just, what is possible, and what is next in the real world gets born. And if you want to understand how movements survive, not just protest, but persevere long enough with the power and influence needed to make real change, you have to look at moments when cultural practice altered the prevailing story about what people believed was possible. Not decoration, not entertainment, not background music to history. Moments when a song or a play or a painting or a story help people see power more clearly, see each other more clearly, or see a future the people in charge did not want them to see. Today, I want to tell a few of those stories. Different places, different times, different art forms, but each one a reminder that resistance is never only political. It's cultural, it's emotional, it's heart-centered, it's imaginative. And sometimes the thing that keeps democracy alive is not a law or a speech or an election. Sometimes it's something people make together. One of the clearest examples of that comes from Mexico in the years after the revolution in the early 20th century. The country had gone through a violent upheaval. Old power structures were collapsing, new ones were still uncertain, and the government was trying to convince ordinary people that this new nation really belonged to them. But there was one problem. People couldn't read, and most newspapers spoke for a very small but powerful elite. So the question wasn't just how to govern differently. It was how to tell a different story about who the country belonged to. A group of artists helped answer that question by pointing out that cultural institutions like museums and large theaters and concert halls are a story unto themselves, a story that often distorts the relationship between the art they held and presented and the people. So, Diego Rivera, José Clemente Orozco, and David Alfaro Siqueiros began painting enormous murals on public buildings, schools, government halls, union spaces, places where ordinary people already gathered. These walls were filled with images of workers, farmers, indigenous history, revolution, violence, and hope. These weren't polite paintings. They argued. They accused. They remembered things the official story had obscured or disappeared entirely. And because they were in public space, people didn't have to go looking for them. They ran into them on the way to work, on the way to school, on the way to a meeting. The murals didn't just illustrate the revolution, they helped make it real. When people could see themselves on the wall, not as victims, not as spectators, but as part of the story, it changed the way they understood their place in the country. And it stands to reason. Once people see themselves as part of history, they are harder to push out of it. That idea that culture can make people see themselves differently shows up again and again in movements for freedom. Sometimes on a wall, sometimes on a stage and sometimes in a song, that makes it impossible to pretend you don't know what's happening. One of those moments happened in New York City in 1939 in a small nightclub called Cafe Society. It was one of the few integrated clubs in the country at the time, a place where black and white audiences sat in the same room listening to the same music. Even that was controversial. Late in the evening, near the end of the set, the lights would dim. The waiters would stop serving and the room would go quiet. And Billie Holiday would walk to the microphone and sing a song most people at the time had never heard before. Southern trees bear strange fruit. Blood on the leaves and blood at the roots. The song was about lynching. Not metaphor. Not suggestion. Not coded language. It described bodies hanging from trees in the American South in plain, unmistakable words. Record companies didn't want to release it. Radio stations refused to play it. Police harassed Holiday for performing it. The club owner insisted on a ritual whenever she sang it. No talking, no applause until the end, lights out immediately after. Because this wasn't entertainment anymore. It was confrontation. People who thought they understood their country suddenly had to hear something they had learned not to hear. And once you hear it, you can't quite go back to not knowing. That's another way cultural resistance works. Not by winning an argument, not by passing a law, but by spreading the story in a way that makes it unavoidable. And by changing what people feel before the impulse to filter and deny takes over. And once the heart starts to change, sometimes the head has no choice but to change with it. Sometimes that movement stays in music, sometimes it moves into the street, and sometimes it moves into the theater, where the audience is no longer just watching the story, but stepping into it. That was the idea behind the work of Brazilian director Augusto Boal in the 1960s, during a period when Brazil was under military rule. Censorship was tight, political organizing was dangerous, people disappeared, public speech narrowed in ways that felt familiar to anyone who has lived through authoritarian times. Boal had been working in traditional theater, writing and directing plays about social issues, but it began to feel that something was missing. The audience would come, watch the story of injustice unfold, and then go home, exactly as they arrived, frustrated, maybe moved, but still powerless. And he started asking a simple question. What if theater wasn't something you just watched? What if it was something you used? Something everybody did? Out of that question came what he called theater of the oppressed, based on the liberatory teachings of his colleague, the revolutionary educator Paulo Freire. In these performances, actors would present a scene, a landlord evicting a tenant, a boss threatening a worker, a police officer abusing authority, and then the play would stop. The audience could interrupt Anyone could come on the stage. They could take the place of the character and try something different. They could argue back or refuse or negotiate or organize. The stage became a rehearsal for real life. People practiced what resistance might look like before they had to risk it outside in the street. The government understood exactly how dangerous that was. Boal was arrested, tortured, and eventually forced into exile. Not because he was carrying weapons, not because he led an army, but because he helped people imagine themselves acting differently. And once people have rehearsed freedom, it becomes harder to convince them that they don't have it. Today, versions of Theater of the Oppressed are used all over the world, in schools and prisons and community meetings, in places where people are trying to figure out how to speak when the rules say they shouldn't. It's not about performance. It's about practice. And that idea that even a small act in a public space can open a crack in a system that looks solid shows up again in more recent movements, sometimes in forms looks less like theater and more like disruption. In 2012, in Moscow, a small group of young artists walked into the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, one of the most symbolically powerful places in Russia. They were wearing bright masks, winter coats, and fairly ordinary clothes. Nothing about them suggested that what they were about to do would travel around the world in a matter of hours. They ran to the front of the church and started singing. Loud, fast, chaotic, the lyrics called out the growing alliance between the Russian Orthodox Church and the government, accusing both of helping to shut down dissent and tighten control over public life. The performance lasted less than a minute before security dragged them away, but someone had recorded it. Within days, the video was everywhere. The group, Pussy Riot, was arrested and charged with hooliganism motivated by religious hatred, a crime that carried real prison time. The message from the government was clear. You can't do this here. You can't say this here. You can't embarrass power in public. But the performance had already done what it needed to do. It showed that a cathedral could become a stage, that a song could become a protest, that a minute of sound could travel further than a speech that took years to write. The action itself didn't bring down the government. Most cultural acts don't. What they do instead is something quieter. And in the long run, just as dangerous to authoritarian systems. They make people see that the story is not finished yet. And once people understand that the story is still being written, they start looking for their place in it. That's what connects all these movements. The murals in Mexico, the song in a New York nightclub, the theater engagements in Brazil, the mask performance in Moscow. Different times, different risks, different art forms, but the same underlying question. How do you keep people human when the system is trying to make them afraid? How do you remind people that they belong to each other when power is trying to separate? How do you help people imagine a future that doesn't look like the one they're being told to accept? Authoritarian systems understand the danger of those questions. That's why they censor artists. That's why they cut the funding for culture. That's why they rewrite history, ban books, control media, and attack universities. Not because art is decoration, because art is memory. Art is rehearsal. Art is imagination. And if people can imagine a different world together, it becomes much harder to convince them that the one they're living in is the only one possible. That's why these stories, and many like them, really matter. Not as nostalgia, not as instructions. Every generation ends up facing some version of the same moment when speech narrows, when fear grows louder, when the future starts to feel smaller than it should, and every time that happens, somewhere someone makes something. A painting on a wall, a song in a dark room, a play where the audience walks on the stage, a performance that lasts less than a minute but refuses to disappear. Not because it's safe, but because it keeps the imagination alive. And as long as the imagination stays alive, democracy still has a place to grow. Artist Change is a production of the Center for the Study of Art and Community. Our theme and soundscapes spring forth from the head, heart, and hand of the maestro Judy Munson. Our text editing is by Andre Nebe. Our effects come from freesound.org, and our inspiration comes from the ever-present spirit of OOC 235. So, until next time, stay well, do good, and spread the good word.